we had a school dance on Friday, I almost always miss school on Monday or Tuesday. And I just thought that was like a normal part of being a teenager.
When I was in middle school and we didn't know what was going on, I was told it was all in my head.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetics and genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we bring you a patient story related to genetics.
It's hard because me and my brother are the only case in the U.S. that we've been able to find with our gene. I truly think it's a life-changing moment when your diagnosis becomes a community and not just this medical term on a sheet of paper.
Devin Schumann is a genetic counselor with mitochondrial disease, specifically mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome. She currently works at Genetic Support Foundation. She is a passionate advocate for people with disabilities and rare diseases and volunteers with both the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation and MitoAction. She is also a member of the first Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Justice Committee for the Accreditation Council for Genetic Counseling.
So, Devin, it's really nice to talk to you. You have mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome. What is that and how do you explain it to people? And can you explain it to me?
Yeah, so mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome is just one of the many different types of mitochondrial disease, or mito for short. Mitochondrial DNA is a little bit interesting. If you flash back to high school biology, right, it's not the genes that you get from both of your parents, but it's these little individual loops of DNA you only get from the egg when you're born. And so for my condition, it's actually one of the few mito conditions that can be diagnosed by a muscle biopsy because they actually look at the muscle and they say, how much mitochondrial DNA does she have? And I didn't have very much. And so the description is kind of the name of it. They tested it and they said, hey, your mitochondrial DNA is depleted. Now, why it's depleted for my family is actually because one of the genes that tells your body how to build one of the base pairs for the mitochondrial DNA isn't working the way that it should, right? So again, high school bio flashback, there's four base pairs in mitochondrial and nuclear DNA, A, G, C, and T. My G is very, very, very low. I have maybe 10% of what most people should have. So when your body's trying to build the DNA strand, if you're missing a fourth of the letters, you have trouble making the DNA, and then you don't have enough of it. So that's what is causing it for me and my brother. And I actually find it really cool and fun to think about. Like, there's actually a letter that's missing. And some of the other conditions like ours, they treat it by putting that DNA letter in pill form, which as a genetics nerd, I just find super cool.
Yeah.
To bottle DNA.
And is the letter missing only from the mitochondria?
Yep. So at this point, that gene primarily makes the G base pair for the mitochondrial DNA. So we don't have it affecting the rest of our body. It's just the form that goes into the mitochondria itself.
Okay. And is that gene, because I know, okay, now I'm getting a little more genetics nerdy than I usually do on the podcast, but I remember like in grad school learning about mitochondrial DNA, it was like such a surprise and like stuck with me how most mitochondrial conditions like are encoded for in the nuclear DNA, which, you know, because there's more genes in the nuclear DNA. So it makes sense. But still like not immediately obvious. So is in your case, the gene that's mutated that's causing this, is it actually in the mitochondria or is it in the nuclear DNA?
It's in the nuclear DNA. So the condition is actually autosomal recessive. Both of my parents carried it and passed it down to me and my brother. So for us, it was just kind of that fun surprise that is autosomal recessive inheritance, right? There's no family history. It just magically pops up in your kids for one generation.
Right. And do you have just one sibling, one brother?
Yep, it's just the two of us. So we joke we're the 1 in 16 odds so that we're both affected. But honestly, I view that as a positive because I am so thankful that we have each other, right? Mm-hmm. Like the odds could have been, or more likely would have been, that only one of us had it. And they would have been alone through this process. And so we both are like, not that we wish that you would also go through what we're going through, but glad to have a friend on the trip.
Right. Yeah. And your brother's older, right?
Yeah. So my brother is 2 years older than me, and he's actually the one that went through the diagnostic odyssey. I joke that I rode his coattails, and after they figured it out for him, they looked at me and went, oh, yeah, that explains a lot.
Yeah. So how old was he when they started to figure things out for him?
Yeah, so really for both of us, our symptoms became more obvious in middle school and high school. Now, more obvious is more in hindsight. There was a lot of like missing school, being tired all the time, things that, to be honest, were pretty dismissed by a lot of doctors, especially for my brother, who's on the autism spectrum. There was a lot of like, oh, well, you just don't like to be in school. You don't want to be in school. Not, oh yeah, you're actually in pain and really not doing well and should be home resting. So he sadly was the guinea pig with all of that stuff. But for both of us, we kind of had an uneventful childhood. I mean, again, in hindsight, maybe I shouldn't have had heat stroke as many times as I did. You know, there were some mm-hmm. clues there. But no, we both played soccer. We both were obnoxiously energetic kids, if anything. So some of my friends joke it's why I'm doing so well with Mito, because I started just as such an absurd ball of energy that even after this condition happened, I'm still an absurd ball of energy that just tires a lot faster.
Yeah. So how old were you and your brother when they finally figured it out? What led to that? I would also think just, you know, the stereotypes get thrown on teenagers of just being lazy, tired, staying up late, would make it like harder to get to that.
Yeah. So I don't think we truly found our answer till we were late teenagers. So for me, I want to say I was 16 or 15 when they did my brother's muscle biopsy and said, okay, this is what's going on. This is your diagnosis. And then I waited to do my muscle biopsy till I was out of high school because I was already missing enough school to take time off for a medical procedure. So I waited till the summer after high school to officially confirm it for me. But I was labeled as probable or suspected because I had all the same symptoms he did, or not all, but we had overlapping ones. But for him, gosh, I don't even think that was his first biopsy. I want to say that was his third or fourth. Again, he was the poor little guinea pig. He went through a lot where they weren't sure because he has a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease since he was born too. Mm-hmm. So he had like a muscle biopsy. He had a liver biopsy. He had a skin biopsy. Like they were searching all different places. And honestly, what led to our diagnosis was a combination of my mom Googling and figuring it out and being like, hey, I think this fits. Someone suggesting it kind of offhand of like, have you ever looked into these? And honestly, my brother having a bad reaction to a medication that they gave him because they thought he might have a different type of muscular dystrophy. And then his body reacted in such an unusual way with muscle wasting that they were like, oh, we need to do a muscle biopsy. And that kind of like started us down that path. I don't know if we ever would have found the answer, honestly, if it was just me. I'm not sure they ever would have hit the point of like, yeah, let's do a muscle biopsy for you, because I didn't have muscle wasting or these, you know, super obviously atypical reactions to stuff that my brother did.
Yeah. And is that still the case? Is his, is it more severe for him?
Yeah. So my brother is a lot more affected than I am when it comes to this condition. It is a pattern we see a lot in the Mito world, though there's a lot of theories as to why sometimes boys are more affected than girls are. But for him, I mean, just being on the autism spectrum made everything like school and accessing care so much harder. He does have more muscle weakness than me, in part because of the muscle wasting, but just overall. So for him, we have like a service dog. So if he falls in an emergency, she can help him get back up. He wasn't able to finish college because the brain fog was just too much. I mean, he's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. But if you don't have the energy to do the work, it's hard to get through college. And he actually just had eye surgery done because his ptosis, droopy eyelids, got to the point that he wasn't able to really see anymore. The surgery went really well, but he just had that done. Last year, he had hand surgery due to very atypical contractions or contractures in his fingers. So, yeah, he's definitely had more of a rough go of it than I have. And again, I forever jokingly say that I owe him. Practically, that means I just buy him a lot of chocolate because he was the one that had to go through all of the hoops and all of the doubting and everything to get here, and still has to fight the hardest to kind of figure out, hey, how do we deal with these symptoms that I might not develop for years afterwards? And so he's the guinea pig. I give him a lot of credit for that.
When your brother was given the diagnosis, so you were late teenagers, I'm curious, was that information that was given to him and like possibly to you at the same time as suspected, like directly, or was that given to your parents, or like how was that handled given that you were minors but still like basically young adults at the time?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is I never saw genetics. I mean, I met with a mito specialist. I mean, I follow with a mito specialist. I met with one at Seattle Children's at one point, but I never saw genetics, which is feels ironic as a genetic counselor. I mean, sometimes a genetics person would pop in the office. So I definitely, during a research study, had a GC pop in to consent me, and she started to draw out the family tree. And I was like, just hand me the sheet of paper, because I was already a GC at that point. But other than that, I had them like pop in. They're like, do you have any questions? It's like, nope, I'm already in college, minoring in biology, genetics. Like, I'm the one that's explaining it to my family, to be honest. I think my brother maybe saw someone once, but we're not even sure. So I guess it wasn't a very memorable visit. I think it was just, I mean, the diagnostic odyssey, people like to call it that. I really call it the diagnostic purgatory, though, because it's rough. It's complicated. There's a lot of moving parts. And so I think for like our family, there wasn't this moment, like the day that they told us, this is what you have that we'll forever remember. It was this evolving, we think this could be the answer. Yeah, this thing seems to back it up. We had done some DNA testing that was negative, and they're like, well, that might mean you don't have it, but we still think you have it. And the muscle biopsy was like, yep, we finally confirmed it. So it was kind of this gradual evolution of this is what we have going on. Mm-hmm. Same for me, because then it was like, we have it for him. And it became, hey, you probably have this. Okay, you probably definitely have this. Okay, now you definitely have it. Kind of a slow over the years evolution. I think my parents are the ones that told me. I think. Yeah. I honestly have no memory. Like, I don't know that moment. I think I have friends that do. They're like, they have the day memorized and it stays in their head as this anniversary. But yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense that in your case, and like given the nature of the disease and your symptoms and you both having it together, that it was just kind of like a gradual sort of probably explanation. And I mean, some diagnoses too come with kind of like dramatic implications, like for family planning or for medical management. And like, given that your age at the time, I'm guessing like it wasn't impacting family planning for your parents. And it sounds like, did the diagnosis help with your medical management? Was it more of an explanation, or were they like, oh, okay, we'll get you this medical care instead?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think the diagnosis made a world of difference because I wasn't even going to specialists, really. I think all I had was a headache doctor at that point. I mean, and I had symptoms that like should have been treated. Like, I was having rhabdomyolysis episodes with every school dance, but I just thought that was normal. I was immune compromised, but I didn't know that I was. I just thought, oh, I get sick a lot. I have decreased pulmonary function. My liver is slightly off, though nothing like hitting the threshold of that's a problem. But the thing with mito is it's this ever-changing norm. Like your baseline changes for a lot of us in the community every couple of years. So I joke about every 2 years, I develop a new symptom. And then I go through the fun experience of, is this life threatening? Do I need to do something? Or is this just my new norm and I have to adapt? And that's pretty typical of the condition. And again, I think that makes it really hard when people ask you, like they do for most clinical trials, when did your first symptom develop?
Yeah,
I have no idea. I mean, I was a very tiny baby at birth, so I think technically at birth.
Right.
But then there were only a couple of noticeable things in childhood, and then it started to become more obvious in middle school, but they didn't figure out what it was till high school. And so who knows where you draw that line? But
can I back you up to rhabdomyolysis episodes at Every Dance?
Yeah. Yep.
Can you unpack that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was having a lot of fatigue in middle and high school. They thought I had mono over and over and over again. Turns out it was just mito. Probably had mono at one point, but it wasn't the answer for 5 years of my life, like they were saying at the time. They were just like, wow, this girl can't stop catching mono. It's like, nope, no, that's not what's happening. But for me, I was missing a lot of school because I was also a tiny little overachiever that was taking way too many AP classes. So I was going to school, exhausting myself, working all weekends. And so I would have what mito communities call crashes, which is where you crash, you run out of energy, your body stops working as well, you sleep a bunch, you have trouble like doing anything, you get really bad brain fog. And I just thought that was like a normal part of being a teenager. And so I never really noticed that if we had a school dance on Friday, I almost always missed school on Monday or Tuesday because I was just used to being out of energy. So I was like, oh, it must just be I'm tired because I went to the school dance and then I did homework all weekend. It honestly wasn't until I went to a mito conference, one of my friends was listening to my symptoms and was like, girl, that's not normal. That's not even mito normal. You need to go talk to your doctor who is in the lobby of the hotel. So she literally like drags me out from the corner we were all chilling in and brought me up to my doctor and was like, tell him what you told me. And I was like, hi, I know you're leaving for the airport, but here are my symptoms. And he's like, I know you're also leaving for the airport, but when you land in Seattle, please go straight to the ER. I was like, oh, whoops. And he's like, is this the first time this has happened? I was like, no, this happened with every school dance, every time I packed up my dorm room in college, and with every single one of these mito conventions. And he just like had the visual version of like a facepalm. I was just like, oh, why didn't you mention this? And I was like, you have to remember, I thought this was normal. So
yeah,
I didn't know it was abnormal to not be able to like walk up a staircase after going out dancing with friends. Like, my bad. But I think that's the perfect summary of being a rare disease patient, right? Like, you don't know what's not normal. And especially when your sibling's going through it, you're like, well, I don't know. We both struggle with similar stuff. So I thought everyone did. My brother, though, doesn't have rhabdo, interestingly enough. They think because he can't push his body past its breaking point as well as I can. Like, because I'm doing better, I can overdo it more and cause these episodes, which luckily I haven't triggered in years because I'm now being a good patient and not doing things that make it worse. But I think the last time I triggered it is just cleaning my house. Like, you know, so I do have to still kind of be careful sometimes.
Yeah. And so rhabdomyolysis, rhabdo is...
Oh, yeah. So...
Yeah, go ahead.
What rhabdo is essentially when you hit your muscles are completely out of energy. When you hit that wall, your body starts to break down the muscles to get the energy that it needs to function. So most people encounter rhabdo if they do CrossFit, Or if you've ever seen those videos of someone who runs a marathon and then collapses and has to be carried off, that's rhabdo usually. Like, you've pushed your muscles so far past the breaking point, they're starting to break down and they don't work anymore. So the symptoms are severe muscle pain. Typically, you have profound muscle weakness. Like, I literally once triggered it while on vacation and had to like lift my knee to step on up onto a curb on a street. Like, I could walk fine, but I couldn't do that motion of stepping up on one step. And then the hallmark that doctors really look for, because a lot of people have muscle fatigue and pain, is really that you have decreased urination. So like chugging water, but barely going pee. And that often your urine actually turns like a dark brown, or they call it like Coca-Cola colored, because it's actually the muscle that has broken down that's leaving your body and that's overwhelming your kidneys, which causes the decreased urine. So in that moment, you can cause kidney failure because you can overwhelm your kidneys enough that they just give up. Good news is not repeated episodes don't trigger kidney failure. It has to be like in the moment. So good news is me ignoring it for a decade of my life didn't actually do any damage. But I don't want to keep spinning that roulette wheel and seeing if next time maybe it does.
Yeah. So what is the answer to that? I mean, it sounds like maybe part of it is trying to slow down and not push yourself so much. But like when your doctor said, oh, go straight to the ER, like what can they do for you in terms of treatment?
They pretty much, it's a combination of hydration. And giving you, so they give you like IVD5, which is like dextrose, essentially give you a lot of fluids and a lot of sugar so your body has easily accessible energy to use so it stops using your muscles.
Okay.
So I mostly treat it, honestly, at home with a bunch of Gatorade. And we jokingly call it my like DIY D5. Because going to the ER is expensive and stressful on your body, and with COVID can trigger other illnesses and things that you can get exposed to. So my little non-compliant patient self will sometimes just watch my CK levels, get orders to draw them at home, and just drink a bunch of Gatorade and treat it at home so that I don't have to go in, again, with my doctor's blessing, knowing that like if it seems to be getting worse, I do have to bite the bullet and go in. But
I mean, that sounds pretty reasonable, like understanding it and treating it at home now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who deal with it often, there's a couple different conditions where it's like a hallmark of the condition. A lot of them do talk about like, oh yeah, I treat it at home. Again, knowing your own history, how high does your levels go? Can you manage that? Are you able to still get up and take care of yourself? Or are you truly stuck in a bed when this is happening, and maybe an ER is a better place for your own like taking care of yourself and safety? But for me, I'm just super tired and muscle weakness, but still able to do a surprising amount of stuff. So one time I triggered it, like I said, on vacation. I honestly didn't go to the ER till I was done with my vacation because I didn't want to go to an ER in a different city I didn't know. So I just like kept my vacation going and did a bunch of walking tours and like still did everything just with like a lot of Gatorade. Maybe not my smartest life decision, but I think it's the reality of rare diseases. Like, you have to find that balance of how much do you medicalize yourself? What risks are you comfortable with? And what do you prioritize? Because you can be the good, perfect patient and go in for all your specialists and end up having like dozens of appointments every year for the rest of your life, which is honestly exhausting. There's a lot of medical fatigue and burnout and medical PTSD that people can get. So we all have to figure out, how do we balance that? Again, talking to our doctors about like what's a safe way to balance all of that. But you don't always have to check all of the boxes.
Right. You mentioned a drug where you just take a like a supplement with the missing base pair letters, but that's available for a different base pair letter and not for G at this point. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's a different condition of mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome called TK2. And they've been bottling the T base pair and giving it to kids, honestly, all over the world. There's a really great family in the U.S. that started an international org to help get people in South America and other countries access to it, which is, again, the power of rare disease families. It's amazing that they've done that.
Is it a huge leap in to make a similar drug for other faith centers?
So it's something that we've been talking about. We have a research team that we work with, and they were working on that. We actually found a different drug that we might be able to repurpose for us, which is a little bit easier of a process. Still not easy because the drug isn't approved in the U.S., but it's an easier process than trying to make an entirely new medication or find a factory that's willing to help bottle it and all of that. So we were exploring that path. And I think we've kind of taken a pause and we're trying to explore the let's repurpose a different med that already exists. And then maybe one day we'll be able to do two meds together. I'm hopeful. I think it's hard because me and my brother are the only case in the US that we've been able to find with our gene. It's a candidate gene at this point, which means it's not really well established. There is a paper that's hopefully published this year that describes us, and there's a couple other people out of Europe that they've found. But they've literally found them by like coincidence. It's like, oh, well, the one researcher who worked in this lab then moved back to Europe and he was talking with coworkers and was like, oh, I think this patient also has it. Like, it's not... it's this very organic, not structured way of finding patients, which honestly frustrates me so much as a GC. I just want to like shout at everybody and be like, do you have our gene? Because it just breaks my heart that there's families that don't have their answer. Mm-hmm. Because it's hard to find other people with this because it's not well described. It's not well published. The way to test for it is either genetic testing, and there's only a couple of companies that have our gene on their panel, or to look at the muscle biopsy and actually look at what levels of each base pair you have, which is not typically done. That's mostly only done on a research basis. And so it's hard to find the other people. And that just makes me so sad because we maybe have a treatment coming.
Right. And what about even just like the clinical diagnosis of mtDNA depletion syndrome? I imagine, I mean, it's just a muscle biopsy. I've never had to have one done, but can you talk about what that's like? I imagine that's something that a lot of people want to avoid. So even if it's suspected, it's like something that a next step that people might hesitate to do.
Yeah. So it used to be the gold standard. It used to be, you think you have mito, you do a muscle biopsy. With genetic testing, most people are like, or I could do that blood test that isn't invasive, okay. Right? Like most okay. people are like, I pick option B.
Right.
But when that genetic testing is inconclusive, the reality is about 40 to 60% of people with a clinical diagnosis of mito based off symptoms will find their genetic answer, which practically means at least half of people won't. And so for those half of people, it does become that discussion of, do we think a muscle biopsy would be helpful? It can rule out things that aren't mito as well, like overlapping other muscular dystrophies. So some doctors still like to do them, but it is invasive. It is a procedure. Typically, it's done with anesthesia, though now some people don't always do that, though that honestly seems traumatic to me that my friends are like, they give you Versed and you don't remember. But I'm like, I don't know if I'd want to have that done awake. So for a lot of people, I think it is a very hard decision, especially when they have teens or young adults. They're like, look, you're already going through a lot trying to find an answer. You're going through all these doctor's appointments, blood work, often procedures like muscle tests, like EMGs or MRIs. And so to add on a surgery is often a step that a lot of people are hesitant to do. And the reality is that for mito, we used to say, if you see mito dysfunction on a biopsy, you have mitochondrial disease. But now we're realizing there's a whole bunch of other genetic conditions that can cause mito dysfunction, even really common things like spinal muscular atrophy, SMA. And so now muscle biopsies aren't as definitive as they used to be for people. It'll often lead to, well, you have mito dysfunction, so you possibly have mito instead of you definitely have it. And so my form of mito, where you actually can see the DNA depletion, is honestly one of the very few. You have a biopsy and it gives you a yes or no. This is now your diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people ask me, like, should I do one? I'm like, well, for me, I'm kind of biased because if we hadn't done them, we wouldn't have our answer at all. But for most people, they probably don't have my rare subtype. So it's probably not going to give most people an answer. So I definitely come back to my genetic counseling roots of being non-directive. I'm like, I can't tell you if that's the right decision for you. Like, I truly can't. Because everyone also recovers differently from surgery. Everyone reacts differently to anesthesia. So for some people, that is a much riskier procedure than for others. And you have to take that into account.
Yeah. What do genetic counselors and doctors miss that might be semi-easily fixable? Like, what should genetic counselors and doctors have in mind to pick up on more people who possibly have mitochondrial disease, especially since it sounds like often there is genetic testing that can be ordered to potentially avoid a muscle biopsy and still get to a diagnosis for at least some people?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the biggest pet peeve I have is kind of where we started this conversation, though you didn't do the pet peeve, you did the opposite, which was really happy. Not saying that it's always caused by mitochondrial DNA variants that are inherited from the maternal family line.
Mm-hmm.
I still hear doctors say, even genetics professionals in meetings, oh, is the kid's mom affected? She's not, probably not mito.
Oh, yeah.
And it drives me up a wall because 80% of people who find a genetic answer, it's nuclear. Only 20% of mito families with a confirmed genetic answer is it mitochondrial DNA itself. And so
it kind of surprises me that it's only 80-20, right? Because there's only 37 genes in the mitochondria. I would think it'd be skewed even more toward the nuclear DNA.
Well, and I think it's heading that direction, right? Like,
okay.
We have 20,000 nuclear genes, give or take, right? We don't know what they all do yet. I once heard a mito doc say every month a new gene is associated with the mitochondria.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was probably just more of a ballpark, but it's to give you that idea. Like, it's rapidly changing. My family, our gene's not published yet. Like, we're one of those that month. We're the new gene. It's really hard, though, to see that so many people go back to the, like, original textbook they learned from 40 years ago, or they go back to the med school lecture that they had that covered mito, that focused on the mitochondrial DNA because it was like the cool, interesting thing that's different about this condition. So they just assume that, like, that's the norm for this condition when it's usually not.
Those are the questions that were on the test because they're complicated.
Exactly. Right. Like, those are the ones where they're like, well, they made me memorize a bunch of abbreviations like MELOS and MRF and LHON. So that must be what everyone has. And it's like, no, most mito families don't fit into, like, one of those boxes.
Autosomal recessive is not on the test. Yeah.
Exactly. There can even be X-linked forms of mitochondrial disease. Like, it can be any form of inheritance, truly. And people miss that memo. And I think it makes it so much harder to get answers for families. Plus, sadly, I think a lot of mito patients, their symptoms are vague and encompass multiple different parts of the body. And so I think just so many mito people get dismissed by medical professionals as, you know, faking it, as lazy, as preoccupied with your symptoms too much. It's really heartbreaking to watch it happen. And honestly, I mean, it happened in my family. Like, my brother was, I mean, all the doctors told my parents, like, you need to force him to go to school. You need to force him to push through it, that he's just faking it. And, like, that really messes up how you view the medical world. And he's done a lot to repair that relationship over the years. But, like, that's a hard place to start your medical journey with, doctors telling you to suck it up and deal with it and essentially gaslighting your symptoms. And even for me, even when I was in middle school and we didn't know what was going on, I was told it was all in my head because I wasn't freaked out by my symptoms enough, which I thought was ironic. I was like, sorry, I coped too well. My bad. But then in grad school, even when I was like at a genetic counseling program, at the university I was seeking medical care, the head of a department told me when I had an appointment with him that, oh, well, we all have genetic changes. So like, you can't read too far into that, because he'd never heard of my gene. And I'm like, would you like me to draw a map of the pathway or connect you with the doctor that like has a mouse model? Because I can do that.
Was this someone who worked like in the genetic counseling program?
No. This was the head of immunology at the hospital. Huh. But he had like 3 med students with him as he said this. So I literally like gave them a mini lecture on genetics and why what the doctor was saying was not true. Oddly enough, I didn't ever see that doctor again. But that's the reality of it, is I think genetics is confusing and mito is confusing and there's not always a clear-cut answer. So doctors disagree. You'll have one doctor say, yeah, I think it's mito. And then the next doctor says, I don't think we have enough evidence to say that. And then the patient doesn't know what to do, or it makes it look like the patient is lying or misleading or doctor shopping, when it's like, well, the other doctor told them that they thought they had it. So like, why is it their fault that they believed one of their doctors? Right. And it's hard because the symptoms are hard to nail down. Like I say I have a lot of health privilege, not just because how well I do with mito, but because I have obviously abnormal things that can be found. My muscle biopsy was obviously abnormal. My blood tests, I have very high CK, I have high lactic acid. Things that are metabolic are obviously abnormal. That's a lot of privilege, because a lot of people, they have normal blood work because they just don't test it on a really bad day. And then doctors are like, see, look, now we know you're faking it because your blood looks fine. And honestly, my biggest message to all providers is always believe your patients. And that sounds so basic. But if your patient's atypical, or they're quote unquote a poor historian, or like me telling you my life story, it's a jumbled all over the place story. It's hard to put in a nice, easy line for the questions that the provider wants answered. And then people get dismissed as like, oh, we'll see, like, it must not be true because they're saying contradictory things, or they're jumping all around, or they forgot half their symptoms. Well, there's just too many to keep track of.
Right. Yeah. For a genetic counselor or a doctor who's listening, who's already on board with that idea of listening to your patients, believing your patients, what constellation of symptoms should they be looking for specifically to not only say, I hear you, I believe something's wrong, but to potentially help the patient get to the next step to say like, oh, maybe this is mitochondrial disease, or where should they refer that patient? You know, like if it's a genetic counselor and they're hearing this, it's like, well, I work in cancer genetics, so I work, you know, like I, maybe it's, I don't know what to do. I mean, I know you work in telehealth genetic counseling at Genetic Support Foundation, so maybe that's one option. They could schedule an appointment to see you. But just like to start with, I guess, to back up my question, just like what are the symptoms that they should say, oh, let's think about mito?
Yeah, the hallmarks of mito come down to a couple of different things. The first one people talk about is like 3 organ systems or more are affected, i.e. you have random symptoms that don't seem to go together. Like my brother has a fatty liver, and he has autism, and he has muscle weakness. Like 3 things that in theory don't naturally occur as a group. So that's one of the hallmarks they say. Particularly, they recommend looking at organ systems that require a lot of energy, like the brain, the heart, the liver, the muscles. So less likely that you have like, oh, well, you're missing one kidney, or you have a hole in the heart. It doesn't tend to be structural changes. It tends to be how the functioning of an organ is getting affected. Often people with mito have symptoms that ebb and flow. It's not always consistent. Typically, it is progressive over your life. Things are getting worse with time. And often they get worse with times that require more energy. So when you're sick, when you're growing, so like as a toddler or as a teenager, when you're going through a pregnancy, which again makes it easy, I think, for people to dismiss it like, oh, we all get tired when we're sick, but kind of that you're having an extreme reaction to things people don't. Like you get a cold and you're in bed for 3 weeks, or you go to a school dance and you can't walk 2 days later. Like there's something going on here. Those are kind of the hallmarks I say to look for. Some of the other ones can be like ptosis, so your eyelids being droopy. That's a really common cause thing that you see in mito. So when I say I have mito, most docs look straight up at my eyes and go, yep, you do, because they can see that. That's one of the only visible things you can often see in people. There's blood work you can do, right? Like looking at CK being elevated, that's from your muscles breaking down to make energy. That can also throw off liver enzyme studies like AST and ALT. That actually can come from the muscle as well. Looking for things like lactic acid, but particularly checking blood levels on a bad day. Like I tell patients, get an order from your doctor. And on the day that you feel horrible and you don't want to go to the doctor to get your blood drawn, that's the perfect day to go. Because we want to catch it when your body is trying to make energy in other ways. Like that's what causes your lactic acid to go up, because you're struggling to make energy and you're doing whatever you can. And so it gets produced. In terms of where to send patients, I mean, you can send them straight to genetics. Honestly, mito is one of those conditions where I really do think having an MD involved, like a geneticist or a neuromuscular specialty clinic, like an MDA clinic, really can be helpful. Because often the first thing I start to look for is the evidence, doing the blood tests for things like CK, doing nerve conduction studies or EMGs, doing strength testing, doing pulmonary function testing. How's your lung muscles doing? Getting an echocardiogram, making sure your heart seems to be going okay, or an EKG, doing some of those investigations to also get that answer of, well, how many organ systems are involved? Because if we don't go check the heart or check the lungs, you might not know that, hey, this patient actually has 7 different organ systems involved. We just never looked into it. So sometimes you do have to kind of jump through those hoops to investigate and gather evidence, and then send them to a geneticist or a mito. There's a mito care network that you can look up. I can send you the link to put with us.
I'll include that in the show notes of this episode.
Yeah. And so there's links where you can find those mito clinics, but honestly, a lot of them have a list of what they want you to do before you get there. So if your doctor tries to refer you, they often will say, hey, can you order these 5 or 10 tests before you send them over? So we can kind of like in genetics, we're like, we want all the info so we can put the pieces together. That's the same with them. They want to gather that info before you make it in the door, which again can be a hoop for patients that can be frustrating. But the mito clinic wants to make sure that when they're talking to you, they can actually give you answers and they don't have to say, okay, now let's go order a bunch of things and come back in a year,
right?
And delay that process. But refer to a mito specialist. Send people to genetics, gather evidence. There's a lot of papers online of what to do. The Mitochondrial Medicine Society has lots of freely available resources on what you do in a workup. Sometimes a neurologist or a PCP can feel comfortable ordering some of those tests to get that evidence prepared for when you send them over.
EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, is such a frustrating kind of fuzzy diagnosis for people, and hypermobility is so common. And I'm wondering if you think that there's some people who happen to have hypermobility who actually have an undiagnosed mitochondrial disease, if that might be a better fit for some people who are maybe kind of in the EDS category, or are those really more distinct than I'm thinking?
Yeah, I mean, my answer is yes and no. So the first answer is, I make a lot of people mad in the mito world when I say this sentence, but bear with me. If you actually look at the diagnostic criteria for hypermobile EDS, the last criteria is you do not have another cause for your hypermobility, such as a muscular condition. Like that's right in the paragraph.
Right.
There's a lot of people in the mito world that are like, I have mito, and I have gastroparesis, and I have EDS, and I have dysautonomia. And I'm like, I think you have mito that's just causing all of those symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And people get really upset when you say that, because I think they hear it as like, you're telling me I don't have EDS when I know I do. But to me, hypermobile EDS, it could be viewed one of two ways. If you actually use a diagnostic criteria and you're saying this is a separate condition, then I would argue people who have mito probably don't also have hypermobile EDS, because that last criteria would disqualify them. But I think practically speaking, a lot of people use hypermobile EDS more as a description, right? It's like, these are, exactly. This is what I'm going through. These are my symptoms. And by that logic, having that label and knowing I meet criteria for hypermobile EDS will help you access resources, exercise guides, friendships, communities that get what you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually how I explain it to people who get really mad when I'm like, well, technically you don't have hypermobile EDS if you have mito. Because I'm like, look, I don't want to take that diagnosis away from you.
Right.
Because it gives you access to people who get it. But are there definitely people who on their journey to mito were first diagnosed with hypomobile EDS? Yes. And then as they learned more, they figured out, oh, I actually have mito or another condition that was causing the hypermobility. Because if you think about it, I think it's like 10% of people are hypermobile. And so when you add in 10% of the population is hypermobile, and you add in, I think it's 2C, I don't know, one of the sections on the diagnostic criteria that say you have chronic pain or fatigue. I mean, that covers a lot of mito people. Most of them have chronic muscle pain. 10% by default should be hypermobile, because 10% of the population is. That's a huge pile of people who probably have that diagnosis that they maybe found first because it's more well known. Or nowadays, mm-hmm. it's talked about on TikTok, so people can access it a lot quicker. And so, yeah, there's definitely a group of people who are, I would say, mislabeled as EDS who maybe have mito. There's also a lot of people who have EDS that probably have like 1,000 different conditions, just like mito has 1,000 different genes that can cause it. I'm sure hypermobile EDS is not one thing. It's probably dozens of different syndromes that we're going to tease out over the years.
Right. And that label is helpful to some people if they can fit in that bucket, but then possibly prevents people from getting, or is a barrier to people getting a more precise or accurate diagnosis that might be a better descriptor of what's actually going on with them.
And they actually talk about that in the mito world a lot, not for EDS, but that what if you stop the diagnostic odyssey by giving a patient a label that's more descriptive? So like there was a paper actually put out by the Mito Medicine Society that said you should never, or they highly recommend not diagnosing people with suspected mito or probable mito, because people were getting that label added and then their doctors were stopping to look for answers. So they never did genetic testing, or they did testing 10 years ago, it was negative. They never revisited it. And so they were very worried that these families were kind of getting labeled as you have mito. And then they never looked into it to figure out maybe you have something else actually, and it just looks like mito. Again, families had a very negative reaction to that paper. And to be honest, I did too, because I think telling a patient we're never going to label you as probable or likely a condition does leave a lot of patients where doctors are like, oh, so you have nothing. It's all in your head, and get dismissed. So I think there's a middle ground that we have to find there. I'm not quite sure how to find it, but I think there is a place where we could say descriptively you meet hypermobile EDS, or clinically you meet mito. But there's then the next level of diagnosis that maybe has a different term involved, like genetic mito or something, that says, okay, we've actually nailed this down. This is your firm and final answer. That leaves a middle ground where people aren't just dismissed and their doctors keep looking, but they also get help with whatever symptoms they have as they keep looking.
Right. It seems like probable or suspected should come with a footnote, or I would think does automatically come with a footnote, where it means well, obviously, like, keep looking. But I can see how that, you know, in genetic counselors, like, generally, like, we kind of have a luxury of time with patients, like, relative to other providers, where you're like, okay, moving on, like, I have something to, like, hang my hat on. And that's interesting. I can see how that just, you know, like, set aside, okay, on to the next thing, and just, like, not going any further.
Yeah, like, I just found it funny, kind of the same way you did. I'm like, okay, but isn't that the definition of the word probable or likely, that it's not set in stone?
Yeah.
But it was still leading to these different approaches by other providers. And so again, like, to me, that means that as a medicine field, we need to do self-reflection and figure out how to fix ourselves if we're ignoring words like probable or likely, instead of putting the onus on the patient to, like, take away a label that could be helpful for them because we're misreading the label. Like, to me, that feels like such a backwards approach. We need to fix ourselves. This isn't the patient's fault that we were making assumptions.
Right. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, like, the term variant of uncertain significance.
Yep.
Where I'm like, well, that's what it is. We don't know, but somehow it, like, requires a lot of explanation and unpacking because I guess because of the context in which it's presented. So it's like, well, but it's, like, written down and it's on there and you found it. And so, like, that context just makes people jump to the idea of it meaning more than it does. You know, it's like, well, it means we don't know. That's exactly there in the description.
But again, it's tempting to think that you do, right? Like, and I always say, like, mm-hmm. it's not your fault that you were tempted by the red herring, right? Like, it sounds like it fits. So it's easy to be like, so of course it does fit.
Right.
And I don't blame people for that. Like, that's a natural human reaction when things seem like they line up to believe that they do.
Mm-hmm.
It's why there's a lot of logical fallacies that have labels like red herring for that reason, because we all fall for it. But again, that means we have to do better as providers, not that we need to stop telling these results to patients because they'll interpret it back like wrong, quote unquote. Like, no, we need to do a better job so that they understand it. This is not the patient's fault if they're like, this feels like it fits. Like, that's our job to fix that.
So you've been a genetic counselor for 7 years. I know you're very passionate about rights of the disabled and people with rare disease. You're very active on Twitter. I'm just interested in hearing from you on how you see the field of genetic counseling helping patients who are disabled and where you see big problems that we need to address.
Yeah, I jokingly call it being shouty. You know, that's my description of, like, when you're just shouting on your soapbox about different topics that you think people need to be more aware of. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I've always been shouty. I was a very precocious, tiny human. And so for me, it was kind of this natural progression of, like, no, if there's something going on, we need to talk about it. And I think for me, in some ways, I was very fortunate for when I was diagnosed, because I was diagnosed in high school, but it had been coming for a while. So it was, like, slowly, as I was figuring out who I am as a teenager, I was figuring out who am I am, someone with a medical condition. And then when I went off to college, it was who am I am as an adult? Who am I as somebody with MITO? Who am I with somebody who is disabled? Like, all of those evolutions happened together. Because when I went to college, literally my orientation, I was walking up a hill in the northeastern hot, humid weather with a girl who also is disabled. And we were looking at each other going, wow, this is not an accessible orientation, as we're, like, dying on this hill together. And everyone's long ditched us because they can walk faster in the heat. And we're still friends today. We were just texting actually yesterday, and she went off and became a lawyer. She has cerebral palsy, and our friendship has been this: you're an adult, you're shouty, you're disabled, and that's always a part of who you are. And so that first year, as I was like, I have disabled friends in high school. It was just me and my brother. I didn't know other people with medical conditions or other disabilities, at least not very well. And so I was like, look at me, I can live on my own at college. I can do laundry. I also can have a lot of disabled friends. And oh, wait, I can have mentors in the disability community. Wait, this is awesome. This is an amazing part of my life now. And so it wasn't this like first introduction to being disabled that sadly I think a lot of people have that follow the narratives of like, you're a warrior. You should be pitied. This is a tragedy. This is a sorrow. You're afflicted by the condition. It was, you're disabled, and that means you get to go to a really cool dinner club meeting once a week, and you get to hang out with the Office of Disability leader who was part of the disability rights movement in San Francisco and like shut down the buses and did all the protests. And so it's always been this positive for me. And then I went to a free pizza lunch where they talked about genetic counseling. And I was like, ooh, I like that too. And so it was like, as I became someone who's disabled, I became a GC.
It's interesting to me that you didn't hear about, I mean, I know you said genetic counseling wasn't really involved until like much later, like very peripherally, but that you hadn't even heard of the field until college.
I had no idea. But if I stayed in my organic chemistry classroom after the lecture was over, I got free pizza and could hear about different health professions. So I stayed for free pizza. And the genetic counselor who gave the presentation, I'm still friends with, Kayla Sheets, it was a women's college. So I went up to her afterwards and I was like, I want to do this. And she's like, let's go have tea. And we went and had tea. And we did it like 3 out of my 4 years of college. She and I had tea and talked about genetics. And so for me, like, it's not different hats. I can't put on my MITO hat, my disabled hat, my provider hat, or my genetic nerd hat. They're all part of who I am always. And so I don't know how to view the field like as a GC who's not also disabled or as a patient separate as a GC. Like it's all one giant tangle of who I am. I do think that that means that I'm also kind of privy to different conversations maybe than other people in the field. Like when I was learning about the field, I was talking to all my disabled friends about eugenics and genetics and the history of all of that because we were all in college and this was the stuff we were learning ourselves as we figured out what it meant to be part of this disability legacy for the rights movement. And so for me, like when I went off, I assumed everyone was having these conversations. I mean, we had an amazing mentor, Laura, who ran our program. She actually passed away last year. So she definitely had a huge impact on our lives. That was very much, no, you're adults. You create the change you want to see. And so when I was at the school, like the club had like it had good and on and off years where a student would lead it and then they run out of energy or they'd graduate and then someone else would have to take it over. Like we started an orientation program when we were there because we're all like orientation was rough. So we started a disabled one, like where you could meet other people from the start. Like it wasn't that these things existed truly, it was that we created them as we went. And we created that friendship circle. And I am very fortunate that we did. I could have ended up at another college or by coincidence not met somebody who brought me into that community. It's part of why I'm so passionate about disability advocacy and community, because I truly think it's a life-changing moment when your diagnosis becomes a community and not just this medical term on a sheet of paper. It just gives you a totally different perspective on it. And I am very shouty about every person should go to a rare disease conference or one for their condition, and that teens need to meet other people with their diagnosis. And it's not this scary, bad thing. What if it freaks them out? It's this amazing, positive change in identity. That, I mean, yeah, everyone copes differently and there's always something that'll freak you out. That's life. And we all have different things that we need. Some people are more active than others, but I always want people to know that's an opportunity that exists.
I feel like that change that you helped create in college, that you're doing the same thing within the genetic counseling profession. Like I know you're a member of the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Justice Committee for, I'll say the whole thing, Accreditation Council for Genetic Counseling, ACGC, as one example. But do you think that's true? And I don't, maybe it's, you know, it's college campus is so radically different from like a professions that's spread out, well, you know, across the country.
I don't know if it's maybe, that maybe different. Not, we're a small profession. I went to a women's college. Our profession is mostly women. It's not, right. not as different as you might think. I think luckily and sadly, it's a double-edged sword. Often in small communities, people who fit various minority groups do have to take on creating the change that they want to see. Mm-hmm. And I am forever fortunate and thankful for social media because there are multiple GC disabled groups. Like there's a Discord and I think there's a Slack. There's different groups that do exist where you can find people who share that identity so you don't feel alone. There's an LGBT one that I'm also a part of. And I think it is important to find your people so that you can make that change, because it is hard to make it on your own. And it's easy to deal with imposter syndrome and self-doubting when you're being shouty about something, because people are shouty back and they're like, we disagree. I'd be like, okay, wait, am I right? I think I'm right. I think I'm coming from a valid place. Yes, yes, I believe this. But I think that's a huge part of growth, right? Like if you're not uncomfortable, yeah. you're not growing. If you're not reevaluating the positions that you take to say, does it work in all contexts? Am I right? Am I wrong? Is this more nuanced than I'm letting it to believe? You're not doing the work. And so I am fortunate that I have the energy to be shouty, and I have a great job that supports that. And I have mentors that support that and friends that I can call after a hard day or a hard moment and be like, can you validate that I should be being shouty? And that burnout is real. And I think there's a lot of people in the GC world talking about that. And the more that we talk about it, the more that other people talk about it. And we see that with so much, especially, I mean, I have a lot of privilege as a white cis woman who has an education and can speak medicalese and is neurotypical that other people in our field don't have. And I think, again, it's important to acknowledge that, like, it's also not fair to always ask people to be shouty when maybe they just want to do the job and maybe they're right. tired. And so part of why I'm shouty is I want people to feel seen. Every time mm-hmm. I'm shouty on Twitter and someone shouts back and I doubt myself, I also usually get 3 messages from a baby GC or someone who's not as vocal going, I felt seen when you said that because I thought that too. And that's what makes me keep doing it. I'm very protective of others, I think, because my brother was bullied growing up. And so I'm like, no, I want to protect the baby GCs. I want the people entering the field to know they're not alone and we are trying to change and we're on a growth towards a positive outcome, even if the growth can be bumpy at times.
Is there anything that you wish genetic counselors knew that they're just like completely missing, like categorically, like a non-disabled GC, that genetic counselors should understand about people with disabilities?
I think the 2 main things that I talk about a lot, because I think make a big difference, is one is being aware and reflecting and perhaps changing the models of disability that we use. So I think when we're all in grad school, right, we learned about the medical model versus the social model of disability. Medical being disability is a list of symptoms. Social model being it's not the person's body that quote unquote disables them. It's society and society not being accommodating and not having universal design like curb cuts. That's what makes the world inaccessible, not the person's body or their diagnosis. But it goes so far beyond that. I mean, I talk a lot about the charity model, the tragedy model, the warrior model, the inspirational model that I think are just so accepted as the norm that people don't even realize that, like, that's a model. So, for example, most rare diseases raise money by going, sadly, or I don't love it, but they go, look at this poor disabled child. Look at what they can't do. Look at how they've lost the ability to walk. Don't you think they deserve your money so they can have a better life? Like, I mean, that's the basis of the telethons that used to happen and most advertisements for most major rare disease orgs like the MDA, Autism Speaks, a lot of them are based around pity. And if they're not, they're based around these overcoming warrior narratives. Help in the fight against this. Help empower the young adults to conquer their bodies. There's a lot of not great messaging in those if you start to digest it and pick it apart. Why is your body framed as the enemy? You know, why do you have to overcome to be worthy of help? Why do you have to be a happy, cute, disabled kid to be worthy of a treatment or a cure or medical access? You can be angry and disruptive and non-compliant and you still deserve good medical care. And I think that's something that I wish more people took the time to digest. Like when we talk about it and we talk about like results disclosures and not just being like, I am so sorry your kid has this syndrome, because that imposes a belief that like that syndrome is bad. But I don't think we always pause that when we go, hey, here's a resource for a website that we're sending them to a family org that's going to be mostly messages of you should be pitied, you need to overcome to be worthy, like that still have not great implications. That's why I tell everyone to watch Stella Young's TED Talk about inspiration porn titled I'm Not Your Inspiration, to again realize that like we're objectifying our patients and people with disabilities when we're like, look at how they overcame. They went food shopping. Isn't this amazing? And it sounds facetious when I say it that way, but I have friends who literally have strangers walk up to them while food shopping to the point that they can't go buy groceries because they are being approached by 10 different people who are sharing stories of their friend in a wheelchair. They're like, I just need to buy stuff and leave. Please leave me alone, but I don't want to be rude. They're like, how do I tell them to please stop talking to me without seeming like a jerk? Because I don't want them to think disabled people are jerks. And like, they're putting all of that on their own shoulders when they're just going to the food store. And so I really wish that we reflected more on all of the messaging that we give families and we give providers and we give students when we train them, and what the practical implications of those messages are, even if they have good intention. The other big thing I'm shouty about is honestly eugenics, which people don't always like to be shouty about because it's such a loaded word in history and term. But as someone who figured out what genetics was while hanging out with disabled people at a college, I thought we were all on the same page. I thought that we all knew that we practice eugenics. And then I started saying that in the GC field and people get really mad. Just today on Twitter, I was talking with someone about it and they're like, that's not fair that you're saying that. And I'm like, honestly, that's not fair as a non-disabled person that you're tone policing and saying I can't apply a word that I would argue is a word that the disabled community owns more than many others. Disabled people were the first people killed by Hitler. We were the example that was like, well, see, look, if people accept killing disabled people, then they'll accept killing others. Like, that's how it started. And, you know, Nazi Germany got their ideas from the American eugenics movement that was at county fairs and was a huge part of our government and was promoted by our presidents. That's the basis of genetics. We came out of the eugenics offices. Like, that's where our pedigree nomenclature came from. That's what our community is founded on. And just because eugenics has had mass atrocity, horrible outcomes, doesn't mean that we live in a Harry Potter world where it's like, he who must not be named. Because we have that history, we need to still talk about it. We need to name it. It's the only way to prevent history from reoccurring. I think sadly we've seen in America how we don't like to talk about bad things that we've done in the past, and that does lead to them happening again, be it concentration camps, the Mexican border, etc. Like, there's a lot to unpack in our history of we avoid a word so we don't have to deal with it. And I do get some of the kickback, because I think there is a big difference between, you know, these are terms, like technical terms, positive eugenics versus negative eugenics. We don't mean like good eugenics versus bad eugenics. We mean selecting for things we consider positive while removing things that we consider negative, like IVF and picking an embryo that's not affected with a lethal genetic condition. That's literally the definition of negative eugenics. You're selecting against procreation of something that you view as harmful or bad. But there's also private eugenics versus public, right? Is it only societal policies made by the government? Or do all the individual actions of individual people making family private decisions have a cumulative effect? And I don't know where the right answer is there. I think many people would want to draw a line somewhere where there is that line between a private decision and public, you know, or societal eugenics. I don't know where that line is. I think we need to have these conversations to figure that out. And I think the sad reality is a society is made up of individual decisions. When these mass atrocities happen, when eugenics occurs, it often is coming down to individual cities and people and families and government officials. I mean, that's society, right? Like, if you look at anything that's a big movement, like voting rights or gun laws or reproductive rights, those movements are a collection of individual actions that build into something bigger. And so to me, that means we have to talk about the individual decisions that we make as providers and as patients and as members of our community, because we are responsible for our society and the outcomes that happen due to individual decisions.
If you'd like to share your story, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com. Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. To support the podcast with a donation, visit graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you would like to dig deeper into the professional issues raised by these patient stories, for $5 a month, you can join the Patient Stories Club. To sign up, look for the link in the podcast notes for this episode or visit graygenetics.com/podcast.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendation.